Your Financial Choices may discuss various financial-related topics and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA. We inform you that any federal tax, state tax, financial advice, or information contained in this communication is not intended to be personalized or specific in nature, or to be relied upon for your personal situation in any circumstance. The advice and information are not intended and cannot be used as a tax opinion letter, nor used for the purpose of avoiding tax-related penalties. For personalized advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I'm a CPA, CFP, and AEP on the web at yourfinancialchoices.com, and you can listen online each and every week at wdiy.org. Today is February 10th, 2021. The markets were mixed but pretty flat today. The Dow was, up at 31,431, the NASDAQ down slightly at 13,972, and the S&P down slightly at 3,909. Our topic tonight is contracts and what you need to know. And I'm really excited about this tonight because I have never had this topic on the show, and I've been doing this for, I think, over 12 years. So contracts, what you need to know, and you'd be surprised. So we're going to review that tonight. We are live. We will take your questions. Lori C. is in the studio with us this evening. We'll answer your calls, take your information, and we ask you to mute your radio so you can hear me without the delay and we can talk without confusion. We discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments. And while I typically have a topic each week, you can still ask questions off topic, and I will do my best to answer them. The number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. And email is also available at yourfinancialchoices.com. My guest this evening is attorney Nicholas Sandercock from Gross McGinley. Nick is a litigator at Gross McGinley, a full-service law firm in downtown Allentown. He assists with the firm's medical malpractice defense and commercial litigation clients. Additionally, his practice includes contract law focused on the wedding and entertainment industry, working with individuals and wedding industry professionals to ensure they understand the contracts they are signing and any obligations and risks they may be assuming. Amidst the COVID-19 pandemic, this area of practice came to the forefront of Nick's practice as business shut down and events were canceled, notably weddings. His wedding law guidance to couples and vendors was featured in articles by the New York Times and the Philadelphia Inquirer, and he continues to review contracts during current pandemic conditions and represents parties in court as necessary. Nick holds undergraduate degrees from LTRIC and UPenn. He earned his JD from Temple University Beasley School of Law, and it is his first time on the show. Thank you, Nick, for joining us.
Lori, thank you so much for having me. It's an absolute pleasure.
Can I tell them how I first learned of you? I was on LinkedIn, and something popped up with Nick doing a jingle about contract law to The Night Before Christmas.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. It's absolutely the proudest moment of my law career.
Well, your daughter helped with the production of it, didn't she?
I would say it would have been impossible had it not been for my 13-year-old daughter, Olivia, who bestowed upon me all of her social media and TikTok knowledge to make sure the lighting was correct, that the teleprompter was right, that it was just a seamless operation on a wonderful snow day.
Well, I thought for the few minutes that you had done that, it was enlightening, and I really had an epiphany, like, oh my gosh, this is a great topic for the radio show, because I think so many people have, you know, contract issues, whether they even realize it or not. So I thought it would be a great opportunity to talk about it. First, is there anything else you'd like to share with our audience before we get started? You're from the Lehigh Valley, is that correct?
Absolutely. I'm born and raised in the Lehigh Valley. I lived in California for a brief period of time, but I'm a very proud graduate of LTRIC. And from there, like you said, I was actually, to the best of my knowledge, the first student to ever transfer from LTRIC to the University of Penn. But I went back and reverse transferred credits to LTRIC. I actually graduated from LTRIC and Penn in the same week, which was a wonderful experience for my mom in particular. And then on to Temple, and into my law practice.
Well, that's a wonderful tribute to LTRIC as well, and I'm thankful that you bring that up because that helps bolster the benefits of community college and the access that people can have through that as
well. Oh, absolutely. I think that the professors and the people that I met there have become lifelong mentors, friends, clients, and I would suffer to think of how my life wouldn't have been enriched by not have gone to LTRIC.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, we're so excited that it landed you here as well. So let's start, if we can, talking about contracts. As I mentioned at the top, it's not really something people always think they're really encountering, but it was one of my, in business school, I had a law course, and one of the most important things I learned from that was contracts, offer, consideration, and acceptance. So I thought maybe we could start with some of the basics and build on what is involved in a contract as we go through the show, and then talk about some of the wonderful, you know, cases that you've had that can demonstrate why it's important to understand contracts. So if you want to kind of dive into that for us.
Sure. I think, you know, where you start at law school is exactly where you started tonight. There's three basic tenets to any contract: the offer, acceptance, and the consideration. You know, the offer, I want to sell you this. I have this service that I'd like to provide for you. The acceptance, okay, I'll take it. And then the consideration, what value is being exchanged for that good or that service. And from there, as so many things in law, there's all kinds of different exceptions and caveats. But I think the tenet to any of that is that it doesn't need to be in writing, but that every contract is different, and there are certain circumstances where contracts do need to be in writing. They don't need to be in writing. The consideration needs to be of certain value and things of that nature.
And that's why it's important to kind of have your flags up and your antenna up, I guess I should say, when you're talking with someone and thinking you might be doing something casual conversation. It could lead you astray if you're not really paying attention, possibly.
Absolutely. I think that contracts are often like a marriage. I think a marriage in and of itself is maybe a romantic contract, but it's also a legally binding contract. And I think business relationships are that way as well. When you're in the courtship, when you're in the offer, when you're considering if you're going to accept an offer or make an offer, you're not worried about the divorce, you're not worried about the breakdown. And I think that's where you see the pressure testing of contracts and the preparation that went into preparing the contract. That's really where it becomes beneficial and it comes to light, is when there's an issue, when there's a divorce, when there's a problem, then you look back to the contract to see what are the terms of the contract, if those terms are enforceable under Pennsylvania law, which I think one of the biggest misconceptions that we see on both sides of a contract is that it's on paper, it's in writing, it must be enforceable, I must be bound to this, and that's not always the case.
Well, let's talk about the consideration part of it. Can we typically think monetary is the consideration, but it doesn't necessarily have to be cash.
Absolutely. I think there are certain caveats to that, but I think the major alternative consideration to monetary would be a promise for a promise. So that you're going to do something for me and then I promise to do something for you. Or if you look at something like a shareholders agreement where you're going to get shares of a company in exchange for certain protections from the company, and your consideration would be in the value of those promises that the company's making back to you.
Interesting. We are going to talk as we go through the show about some of this and how this all kind of plays itself out. You've already mentioned a number of different ways we can have contracts. We've talked about, you said, a wedding contract. It could be a business contract. So as we're going through the show, we are going to explore where we might even see some contracts at a personal level, even in our home. It doesn't mean that you have to have a business. It doesn't mean it has to be a shareholder agreement or a partnership agreement. So I want our listeners to know that there are some very important elements of contracts that you have to understand. For example, if you're buying a home, selling a home, pieces of real estate, if you're having someone come in your home to do some work. And again, also, we want to certainly visit Nick's experience that he's had with these wedding contracts in the past several months with the pandemic, because this could continue even for several months more. Folks, if you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. And we are speaking with attorney Nicholas Sandercock from Gross McGinley. I almost said Morgan Stanley. I don't know why. From Gross McGinley. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and it may be tax deductible. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices right here on WDIY 88.1. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. You can talk live on air with us, or if you're not comfortable talking on live, give your question to Lori C. She'll write it down and bring it into the studio. Again, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We are talking with attorney Nicholas Sandercock from Gross McGinley, and we were kind of touching on the idea of contracts and the elements of offer acceptance and consideration. Nick, did we kind of cover what we needed to there, or is there anything more we want to add? Because then I want to go to kind of some everyday situations we might see contracts in.
Sure. I think that the one important thing to think about is, other than the offer and the consideration we talked about not necessarily have to be monetary, but also contracts don't necessarily have to be in writing. Now, there are exceptions to that. Typically, long-term contracts, if it's something that's going to be that the scope of the contract is going to last longer than a year, typically that is something that would need to be in writing. The sale of real estate we touched on, but that would typically need to be in writing. The sale of goods is governed by a body of law, statutory law, the UCC, which would demand typically that anything over the sale of $500 would also need to be in writing. But beyond that, there's oral contracts everywhere we go as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so where would we see some kind of typical contracts in everyday life? Like I just think of people coming into your home to, you know, replace windows or, you know, redo your kitchen or something.
Absolutely. I think that's a huge part of my practice, and what we see more often than not are people have the best intentions of hiring contractors. But there's a very specific statutory regulation for contractors coming in to do home improvements in terms of the Pennsylvania Unfair Trade Practices Act that has a very strict set of guidelines in terms of those contracts have to be in writing. Now, that's not something that covers building a new home. There's actually a dearth of sort of statutory protection for consumers in that regard. But for having a home improvement contractor come in, things as simple as giving you the start date, the anticipated end date, the value of the goods that are going to be used, the materials that they're going to be using, putting their contractor license number down. There's also things that you'll see in those contracts that the unfair trade practice would say are per se void in terms of taking away some of your rights for attorney's fees, or mandating that they have to go to arbitration, things of that nature. So it sort of circles back to one of our starting points, was just because it's in a contract doesn't necessarily mean it's enforceable. It's just a matter of understanding how the law applies to what type of contract that you're getting into. And I think even on a more mundane level, we see contracts simply going to buy a pack of gum is a retail contract. There's an offer to sell the gum. There's a exchange of consideration in the monetary value and the acceptance of that offer. And you also see it, the terms of use that pop up on your iPhone or when you go to a website. It's something that we've seen in the news lately where people think of the First Amendment and the Constitution as this overarching thing, but it doesn't necessarily cover private business. And you have to be very aware of the terms of use when you enter into an agreement with a server to host your website or just going on a website and what you're allowing them to do with the information that you're entering into their website.
And so many of us don't even read those terms, really. We just scroll down. Just out of curiosity, do you as an attorney read those terms?
Unequivocally, no.
I
would say that I'm as guilty as anybody else, and I think that that's something that we've seen where they make it almost impossible to read it all. And we've seen that as a topic of litigation, where if you have 20 or 30 pages of iTunes terms and conditions to accept, are you really going to be able to read that? And we've seen it in certain industries where the type of print, the type of language that they use, is there a genuine ability to negotiate the contract? And all those things go into the enforceability of the contract as well.
Well, I think you said something really interesting, a key word that caught my attention, and you said arbitration. So one of the things I was wondering when you were talking about maybe a builder and there's contracts for a building, and then you mentioned something about maybe not being able to sue directly, you could go to arbitration. Do you mind talking about that just for a moment so people understand what that means?
Absolutely. Within the jurisdiction of Pennsylvania, typically there's three levels of lawsuits. You have, and it's based on the value of the lawsuit. So if the value at stake in the lawsuit is less than $12,000, typically that would go to the magisterial district magistrate. Those are the courtrooms that you see in strip malls,
right,
and sort of innocuous places.
Yeah.
And you'll have an elected judge that presides over it. It's a much simpler process to initiate the lawsuit. It's cheaper to get into court. The filing fees are less. And it's much quicker, I think, typically from date of filing to, you know, pandemic aside, from date of filing to actually getting into court is usually within 60 or 90 days. But then that would be immediately appealable to a compulsory arbitration level, which would be less than $50,000. And that's overseen by the Court of Common Pleas. Typically, then your case would be presented to a panel of attorneys who would act as the judge in the case. And then if you decided to appeal that decision, or if the original value of the lawsuit was above that threshold, then you would end up in the Common Pleas Court. And those are the traditional courthouses that we see in the different counties. And you would be presided over either a bench trial by just a judge or a jury trial with a typical judge and 12 jurors.
So the jury trial is different than arbitration. Arbitration, I thought the parties had to agree together. Is that the magisterial?
You can have an arbitration clause in a contract that would mandate arbitration. There are also certain organizations that are private organizations that promote arbitration, such as
financial industry. It's all about arbitration.
Absolutely. And it is, what's nice about that is the parties can sort of a lot of times set the ground rules. They can pick the arbitrators, because there is a private arbitration aspect as well, that regardless of the value of in controversy, if you're a contractor, maybe I'm the subcontractor, and we have a arbitration provision, we could say that we have to go to AAA arbitration, which is one of the widely known organizations, and then we can sort of set our own ground rules for the arbitration. You can get into the weeds of it. There's high-low arbitrations where you can sort of set the stakes. Okay, even if I lose, I'm still going to get this amount of money, and even if I win, it's going to be capped at such a level. So there's always varying.
Okay, so there are times where the system wants you to kind of work it out with each other so that you're not clogging up the courts with people suing here and there.
I think you very succinctly described what the attitude of the judicial system is. I think that's a good thing, because I think that ultimately what the judges and the courts want to do is for people to come to conclusions on their own. They want to work the decisions out. They ultimately don't want to have to render a decision that's appealable or to be pushed to the next level, that they really want the parties to work together. But at some point, that is not always the case.
Okay, so there are going to be certain times where we might not worry about such things when we're agreeing to terms on, you know, the iPhone or something like that. But there will be other circumstances where we'll want to be very, very careful what we're getting into, whether it's a business or something like that. Folks, we are talking with attorney Nicholas Sandercock this evening from Gross McGinley. We are talking about contracts and trying to understand how important it is for us, even as individuals, not just business owners, but we're going to cover some of that as well, to understand the ins and outs of contracts. I think it's really important. I'm very excited to have this topic tonight to be able to talk with him because it infiltrates our life more than we realize. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810, and you can talk live on air with us, or if you're not comfortable talking live on air, just give your question to Lori. We'll be back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
American folk music offers a variegated pattern of performers and styles. I'm Tom Druckenmiller, your host for In the Tradition. Together, we'll trace the roots and branches of American folk music from the earliest recordings and performers through today's talented players. In the Tradition, Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org.
Hi, welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices right here on WDIY 88.1. If you have questions this evening, the phone number is 610-758-8810. You can talk live on air with us, or if you're not comfortable talking live on air, you can give your question to Lori C., and she will bring it into us. And the phone number again, 610-758-8810. Nick, before the break, I kind of went off on a tangent talking about arbitration just because I know that we see it in the financial services industry. Sometimes it's not always about that. But I want to bring us back to talking about contracts that we might have in everyday situations. We know that you have been featured in the New York Times, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and you've had various vlogs probably regarding all of what you've encountered over the past year for the wedding contracts. But let's, before we get kind of into that in a little bit more detail, because I think that really demonstrates what we're trying to talk about tonight, and that'll be good examples. But we have, rental agreements, we buy cars, we buy real estate, we buy businesses. Do you think that some of these types of contract relationships need to be reviewed more than others? When do we have to pay attention?
I think it's always good to pay attention.
Good point.
But I think that more importantly, I think obviously as the value of the contract goes up, the risk goes up as well. I think we talked briefly off air about the idea of starting a business, and if you're going to have people coming in and out of that business, or if you're going to be selling liquor at that business, and everybody, a business is like the marriage again, where it's the idea of everybody thinks of the creative things. You want to do the creative things. You want to do the fun stuff. You want to see your dream come to life, but you have to protect that dream by properly forming your partnership, your LLC, or however you want to, or private corporation, whatever it's going to be, so that it's structured properly so you as an individual are protected. You also want to have proper operating agreements and things of that nature, so if you have a partner and you have a falling out, that you understand what each is entitled to, that you're not spending more money than is at stake just to litigate a bad breakup between partnerships. I think also we take for granted the idea, for instance, of buying a home, that you have a realtor and they're incredibly knowledgeable about the buying and selling of real estate, and they're educated to a certain degree in real estate contracts. But I think it's also important to get an attorney involved in those situations because, I think within the contract and in the legal industry, you always think of it as an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And having somebody look over the terms of the agreement of sale so that you understand if there's an issue that you find out after the fact what your remedies are. We talked about arbitration, but a lot of the real estate contracts, what you'll see is a term that demands mediation. So for instance, if you buy a home, one of the things that you see a lot in my practice is a failure to disclose. Maybe there's a latent defect in the home latent being that it's not immediately obvious to the layperson when you walk in. Now, you're going to have your inspector going in, and people think that that sort of absolves them, and it'll be the inspector's fault if they miss it. But a lot of times, that's not the case, and a lot of times, really, that the only thing you could recover from an inspector, in my experience, would be the value of the inspection, which $500, $1,000, but if you have a leak in your basement that costs $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 to fix, that's not going to do much. So per the terms of most sale agreements for real estate, you'll have to go to mediation at the Board of Realtors. And there what you have is an attorney sitting in a boardroom and trying to get the two sides to meet in the middle and figure out if the facts if there's facts to sort of motivate a settlement. And it's like you said before, it's the system is set up to try to get people to settle before they actually have to go to litigation.
So I don't know if people might have realized that they would have had some remedies. I liked that word. I wrote that down. That they would have some remedies. So that's why it's important to have a lawyer review it, because in that contract you could provide that there could be some remedies.
Absolutely. I think that within certain industries, especially we talked briefly about purchasing a car, that's a highly regulated industry in terms of what's in a sale contract for purchasing a vehicle, that there's statutory protection from the federal government as well as states that oversee how those contracts are written, what goes in there, what must be disclosed to a buyer. And certainly within real estate, there are certain things. But I think what's important for a consumer to do, even if it's just having even if there's no wiggle room in terms of the terms of the contract and being able to adjust them prior to executing it, is to fully understand what it is and to have an attorney review it, to understand if they do have negotiating power. When people buy a home, for instance, they think about negotiating on the sale price. They don't think about negotiating on the terms of the disclosure, but there's all types of things in terms of what encumbrances are on the property in terms of easements and liens and things of that nature, that it's always good to have an attorney that's knowledgeable about the practice go in and review to make sure that you're buying your dream home and not sort of the can of worms, so to speak.
Right. So interesting. Even I was thinking with rental agreements, because that's something that we especially see even in a college town. I know when my daughter went to school down in Philadelphia, she was in a rental, and they didn't come in and check over the apartment when she came in, and it was filthy, and we did all the cleaning. And then when they checked out, no one came in and reviewed it, and they tried to hold their deposit, and the apartment was completely spotless. And the landlord was trying to hold their deposit, and they weren't giving it back. I didn't look at a contract. I didn't see what it said. I did mention that the IRS does check books for rental deposits, and all of a sudden the check came.
Well, and absolutely. So. I think your experience shows that it's amazing what a little bit of knowledge can do, because I think my experience through the pandemic has been just that. When people sign something and they assume that the party that drafted the contract has all the power after they sign it, it's amazing what a little bit of information can do to sort of shift that balance of leverage. And I think oftentimes, similar to your experience, where you have a negative experience where you feel like you've been wronged, that the other side may push back on you just to see if you're going to be the person that seeks the knowledge, that gets the attorney, and then all of a sudden you get an attorney involved. I always say there's a certain percentage of chance that all of a sudden their tune changes and you can avoid litigation because they know that, oh, this isn't someone I'm going to get something over on.
Yeah, interesting. Let's talk about some examples. I want to go back for a moment. You had mentioned about the Pennsylvania Home Improvement and Consumer Protection Indemnification Act, or was that different than the unfair trade practice? Is that different? Because one is for home improvement.
Sure, they're sort of intertwined. The Consumer Protection Act and the Unfair Trade Practices Act are sort of intertwined. The Consumer Protection Act protects the average consumer from contracts regarding the purchase of personal services or goods, and the Unfair Trade Practices Act is relevant towards home renovations and things of that nature. Like I said before, it does not cover new home construction.
Okay.
And there is also there's the Prompt Payment Act, which has a much more eloquent title, but is commonly referred to that actually protects subcontractors and contractors within the construction industry, which applies to if they're working on buildings or complexes that are 7 units or larger typically, so that contractors and subcontractors, those agreements that they have for payment and what constitutes substantial work being done and things of that nature are all governed by statutory clauses
It's funny. I think a lot of people have been talking about real estate in the past year, and we see more clients interested in real estate and whether they do it themselves or go into some kind of private equity. But for people who are trying to get into real estate, it's obvious from what you've talked about so far this evening that you better really make sure you got a lawyer involved, because there could be very different, I just lost my word, different instances that you have to watch out
there's
for.
Certainly, I think it's almost, you know, I watch these shows where they flip houses and things of that nature, and it's amazing. You watch like Homes on Homes, where they rip down these, they open up these houses and they literally are a can of worms. And that's the kind of, it's a hard situation for someone that's buying a home thinking they're moving into their dream home. But for someone flipping a home or selling a home, the idea that they know something's wrong with the house, but then still selling it as if there isn't something wrong with the house, that's really where you start to get into the real liabilities and downfalls of getting into that business.
Okay. Folks, we're at the halfway point. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Good evening, WDIY Lehigh Valley Public Radio. I'm Shondi Gray. It is now 6:30 and 30 degrees, partly cloudy skies. Lehigh Valley weather tonight is going to get low to 29. Thursday night is going to be snow, high 32. Thursday night is going to be low 17. Friday, partly sunny, high 20. Friday night is going to be low around 15 degrees. Saturday, a chance of snow, high 29. Saturday night, low 21. Now, back to your financial choices with Lori Seabird.
Thank you, Shondi. Welcome back, folks. I have with me this evening Attorney Nicholas Sandercock from Gross McGinley. And we are talking about contracts this evening. So if you have questions, you can talk live on air with us. Or if you're not comfortable talking live on air, you can just call Lori C. She'll write down the question and she'll bring it into us. So learning so much about contracts and how it really permeates through all of our lives in every way, even when we're buying gum, as Nick indicated earlier. You know, my brother-in-law, who passed away several years ago, was an attorney, and you mentioned about buying the gum, and you're a consumer and you buy something. I remember he bought Ralph Lauren shirts, and he felt that Ralph Lauren shirts should last 10 years because of the price. So he felt that that was like a contract. His agreement was, I'm paying this extra money for this, and he would go get new shirts all the time just based on that presumption somehow.
That's funny. I remember growing up, there was a dirty little secret that if your Nikes wore out, that you could send them back to the factory and they would ship you brand new ones without.
Yeah.
So now I believe they've closed that loophole. But it's a similar sort of idea that, you know, you pay a certain amount for something, you expect something in return. And I think that speaks to every contract, that the more you pay for something, the more you expect to be protected for the value of what you've purchased.
Okay. One of the things that we had talked about, and I think you even had alluded to it at the beginning of the show, you mentioned that through the pandemic, you found that there's a lot of pressure testing out there. And I think you were referring to, you know, adhering to the terms of contracts, or that there, you know, might be room to move on some of these things. Can you kind of talk about that a little bit? Because I think that, you know, listeners, folks who are trying to get educated about this, sometimes they need an example. They need to understand so that they can, you know, put something to the story to help them understand it for their own circumstances.
Absolutely. I think that 99 times out of 100, when you enter into a contract, you honestly believe that the contract really doesn't matter because you trust the person on the other side. You expect that you're going to get what you anticipated. You think of the gum example. I'm going to buy this gum. I'm going to take this gum. I'm not even going to take the receipt. You keep the receipt. So I don't even have a record of the transaction. But, you know, what are the chances I'm going to need to anticipate what this contract really is? And what you've seen with the pandemic is that, especially in the service industries such as the wedding business, where people have made $20,000-$30,000 deposits for events, and now the events are impossible because of governmental restrictions. There's certainly a pressure testing there as to looking back into what's in the contract. And then all of a sudden, maybe for the first time, people are really reading the contracts. And especially you think about, we spoke really early on in our conversation about the idea of, was there a genuine chance to negotiate? Did you really feel like you had the ability to try to change what the terms of the contract were before you entered into it? And I think oftentimes the wedding example is a great example of maybe you don't feel that way. I think oftentimes when you go to a venue and you're there with your fiance, I would shudder to be the person to contemplate, well, what happens if we cancel this wedding? I think you might as well not sign the contract there, right? Because your fiance would probably just take care of it on the spot. So you're not thinking about canceling the contract, the wedding contract, when you're signing it. You're also worried about the date. That's what matters. Everybody wants the Saturday in September or the perfect day in April, and they're worried about getting the date. So oftentimes they get into these situations where the venue or the vendor is going to say, okay, well, I have it open, but it's first come, first serve. I don't hold it open for anybody, or you have to pay X amount of dollars. And then essentially you have a contract, an option contract, to hold the offer open for a certain period of time. But oftentimes it's the first example where, okay, well, you have until this date to sign this, or I have somebody, there's always somebody else that's going to take the date, and you feel that sort of pressure to get it done. And you never think about having an attorney review the contract, because you're sitting there getting ready to get married. Of course we're going to get married. Of course it's going to be a beautiful day. It's going to be 70 degrees and sunny, and the birds are going to be chirping, and everybody's, you know, there's not going to be any restriction in travel or anything like that, and we're not going to have to worry about masks and social distancing. All of a sudden something like the pandemic hits, and for the first time you're Googling what a force majeure clause is to see, because it's in this contract, and you had no idea really what it was.
You're going to have to explain what force majeure means.
And I think force majeure is essentially, it's those act of God provisions. And I think that when you know, looking at the wide variety of contracts that I've seen for these type of events, you know, oftentimes they're very one-sided. They protect and try to indemnify the service provider from having to provide the service in the event of an act of God. And you think about something like the pandemic, which was absolutely unfathomable a year ago, and now we've been 12 months living in this sort of alternate universe, so to speak. So there's the force majeure. There's also what we consider liquidated damages, or if I cancel this contract, what is it going to cost me? And I think that we talked a lot about the statutorial things, that the statutory provisions in Pennsylvania, the Unfair Trade Practice Act, the different pieces of the real estate law that govern certain types of contracts. But for a wide variety of contract, it really just relies on the case law to govern what is an enforceable provision within a contract. So when it comes down to damages, people just oftentimes assume that if it's in the contract that, oh, if they can't have the wedding and they have $20,000 and now they can't throw the wedding, they don't provide me any service, they can keep all of my money. And in reality, that's not always the case. Pennsylvania has case law that stood for nearly a century that you can't necessarily profit more from a canceled contract than you can from one that's fully executed. So the idea that if you've made $30,000 deposit on a wedding venue to have your wedding, and they never actually have to put the wedding on, they never have to pay their staff, they never have to buy any of the food or the alcohol for you or anything like that, all of a sudden they've made a windfall profit that they never would have made had the wedding actually gone on.
Let me ask you a question about that. So do you think there are, could something happen where a vendor makes that assumption that, hey, you put this deposit down, you're the one who's canceling the wedding, I'm going to keep the deposit without understanding the law or what the contract actually says. They just make the assumption they can keep it. And then the bride and groom say, well, they told me it's in the contract and, you know, I've given that up now without taking it any further. Does that happen?
Absolutely. And I think it's just like the example we talked about with your daughter in the lease that if you don't know any better, you don't know any better. And I've seen it from both sides, and I've helped people on both sides of sort of the wedding aisle, so to speak, here, where we have vendors that are all of a sudden realizing that they got their contract from online or it's cobbled together from several other contracts. They don't necessarily know what their contract means. And then you have consumers that are really unaware of what the contracts mean as well. And if you take it just at face value, you could be selling yourself short in terms of what you can recoup, because I think that the one thing that's obvious through the pandemic is that these people they're not canceling weddings. The weddings have become impossible.
Right.
And that's an entirely different sort of perspective on how the case law and in the common law in Pennsylvania views the enforceability of a contract that's made impossible.
Would someone have to be careful then how they speak? Do they have to say, I'm not canceling the wedding? It's impossible to have the wedding when they're, you know, discussing it with the vendor or the service provider?
I clients that I engage with, I absolutely caution them into the language that they use. And I think it's why it's a good reason to get an attorney involved sooner rather than later, because it's certainly something that can be unpacked because you look at the circumstances of it. But it's probably best to not be said that, oh, we're canceling this, because then you may be reverted back to the cancellation provision in a contract, and then you're battling over if the cancellation provision is enforceable based on if it's really a punitive cancellation provision where they're punishing you and trying to prevent you from canceling because of what's at stake if you do cancel, versus what a vendor would be entitled to, because, you know, let's be honest, just all the money isn't spent on the day of the wedding. There is administrative fees and things like that. And the law would say that they would be entitled to keep some of that. So I think what's important is understanding the contract. And from the vendor perspective, understanding when you write a contract, what you're really entitled to. So when you hand the contract to somebody and they sign it, that you can feel good about, if this goes to court, my reality is going to match my expectations. And I always say that's what happiness is when your reality meets your expectation.
What about if someone's listening to the show now and they say, hey, that actually applied to me and I had no idea that I had any recourse, and it's 8 months later? Is there a timeline that someone has to, you know, find some of these remedies?
Sure. There's statute of limitations is something that I think people hear in a lot of different ways. They hear it in criminal law, but it also applies in civil law. And depending on the situation, it varies. In typical contract situations, you would see it between 2 and 4 years. I think it's best to sooner than later get someone to look at it so that an attorney can evaluate it and find out where it really falls into play, so that you actually, you know, you're not making assumptions that will prevent you from a potential recovery down the road.
Well, the other reason sooner than later is I would have some concern that some of these service providers may not be able to stay in business after some time as well. And if they have your deposit and now they've gone out of business, all of a sudden we have, you know, creditor
sure.
lining up.
And that's exactly, I think you used the right word. One of the big concerns of a lot of the clients that I'm dealing with is that, you know, a lot of the wedding venues aren't owned by large corporations, and they're on tighter budgets than a lot of people anticipate because of the amount of money that they're spending on their weddings. They assume that these people have all the money in the world, and that's not necessarily the case. And I'm definitely not unsympathetic to the position of the small business in this perspective, but I think fair is fair. And if you are in a litigation and the other side claims bankruptcy, oftentimes it'll stay the litigation, it'll pause it, and the bankruptcy case has to go forward, and then you get put in line with everybody else. And oftentimes that means pennies on the dollar recovery, if anything. But also, I think, stepping back to what we spoke about earlier about the formation of a business, is that's why it's so important to insulate yourself individually from your business as an entity and having an attorney structure that properly, because that's what allows bankruptcy to be a shield from your individual assets, so that if your wedding business goes under, that you're not losing your house and your car and your your savings account as well.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Nick, we've been talking about weddings as an example, but, you know, there are plenty of people out there who may have had, you know, other situations. It doesn't have to be a wedding. It could have been a business event or, you know, a client event or something else that folks might have had, or some type of other contract is basically what we're talking about tonight, and what kind of remedies might be available to people on both sides of that, and also how important it is to review the terms of these types of agreements beforehand. We are talking this evening with attorney Nicholas Sandercock from Gross McGinley in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Nick, what is your website if people want more information? And are the vlogs there as well that people can
absolutely
go to?
We have a wonderful marketing manager, Andrea, who oversees all of our bios and our blogs. If you just go to grossmcginley.com, we have around 40 attorneys in our firm. Like you said, we're a full-service litigation firm. Not just litigation, but business services, all, real estate, and everything in between, criminal defense, all kinds of things. So if you just go to the if you go to the website, grossmcginley.com, you can search for individual attorneys. You can search by practice area, whether it be family law, criminal defense, or wedding law, whatever you'd like.
Okay, and Gross McGinley is GrossMcGinley, grossmcginley.com. Folks, we are at our last break. If you have questions, we still have plenty of time. Phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services including portfolio management, tax return preparation, and financial planning for the accumulation years, retirement years, and estate distribution. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
This is WDIY Executive Director Greg Caponia wishing everyone a Happy New Year, and thanks for your continued support as we proudly begin our 26th year serving the Lehigh Valley community. As we enter 2021, we are aware of the challenges facing small businesses working to retain their customer base while reaching out to new customers. If you run a small business, let us help you get the word out. For the next 4 months, we will be offering affordable underwriting messages geared to small business. For information, please send an email to greg@wdiy.org. Thank you.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices right here on WDIY 88.1, and podcasts of prior shows are also available there at wdiy.org under Public Affairs, and this program will be there as well, probably in a few days. Give us a few days to get that posted. Prior shows, again, are available there, and as we mentioned, Nick is with Gross McGinley, and I have actually had a couple other attorneys from your firm on the show. We've had Nick Nanovic and Alan Tuller on, which have brought their knowledge more around estate planning. But I've been very excited to have you on the show for to talk about contracts. So I really appreciate it. I think it's really something important. It's funny, people take time to buy insurance, you know, auto insurance and homeowners insurance and life insurance to protect themselves from risks. And we don't often think about protecting ourselves from risk that don't seem as obvious to you. You can't always anticipate what's going to happen. So, you know, looking at a contract for something especially important. And I think it was a good ruler that you mentioned about the value. The more value, the more you probably want to make sure you're having an attorney look at it. But sometimes we might not even be able to anticipate the value. So when someone's starting a business, they might not know where that business is going to go. And sometimes they start off and they may not have, you know, tons of funds for something like an attorney when they want to put the funds into, you know, maybe the office or the products that they're building. But that really is a mistake, because that business really needs to be protected, because it's not just the business, it's their personal assets. Can you go over that a little bit about the importance of contracts? And it doesn't mean just a contract between two people. A contract could be an operating agreement.
Absolutely. I think one of the misconceptions, I think, is the expense that's involved in doing some preemptive work and having somebody review the contract. I think that, especially at our firm, I think it's something that we always look at the situation and what's at stake, and we want to add value and we understand the value that we're adding, but we also can't make it prohibitively expensive to have somebody take advantage of what you have to offer. And you know, I have a client recently that purchased a small business, and the guy on the other side was eager to sell. He was going to get the business and everything, and then it's like, well, he came to me initially. I met him as someone that wanted. He provides wedding services, asked me to review his contract, really liked what we did there, and then he thought, you know what, I should get them involved in this sale of the business. And it was really good that he did, because he started to bring up ideas and concepts that they don't anticipate. For instance, if you buy a business from somebody, you're going to be able to use the name.
Mm-hmm.
What's the proper way to form your business? What are the ramifications of having an LLC versus a partnership versus a closely held corporation of another kind? And how does that affect me long term when I'm purchasing the business? Should I do it individually, or should I purchase it through this other entity, and things of that nature? When it comes to operating agreements, I think that it's always good to have those things in writing and to have somebody to draft them up so that you have a clear understanding. I think that it makes for a good partnership to really get it down on paper. You understand what people's roles are, what's the expectation from each other, so they're not fighting it over at the end. I think a partnership agreement is pretty much akin to like a prenup in family law, where nobody wants to think about the breakup. But that's oftentimes when these things come into play, is and how expensive do you want that breakup to be? It's so much easier to and so much less expensive to take the time to put it in writing, to have an agreement that everybody's negotiated, understood, and understands what it means, so that if the worst case scenario comes, it can be applied to it. And the same thing for you know, we talk about the event contracts, but if you're forming a business that's going to be hosting events and you're going to be serving alcohol, what's in your how would you handle the indemnification of the acts of your employees or the acts of the guests within your venue when you're hosting an event? Are they indemnifying you from their own negligence? Are you indemnifying the guest from your employees' negligence and things of that nature? It's stuff that, you know, I think contracts really come into play in the worst case scenario. It's not often something that everything's going happy and well, and then we're looking at the contract framed on the wall because we're so excited that we entered into it.
I always say, if you plan, chances are nothing happens. It's when you don't plan that you end up running into problems. So, and I, you know, I'm a financial planner as well, so you tend to follow the threads. And I think as attorneys, you have that, you know, outlook as well. You're trying to follow the threads as to, you know, unanticipated circumstances.
Absolutely. And I think that the one thing that I've learned, and my clients have learned through the pandemic experience, is really there are a lot of really good businesses out there that they want to make sure that their clients are comfortable with what they're getting into and the contracts that they're signing. That if you ask someone, hey, can I have a couple days for my attorney to look at this, that they're receptive to that. And I think the law would say that they would have to sort of allow you the opportunity to review it and to at least offer terms of negotiation. And it's amazing that, you know, I have private clients that engage in contracts with large businesses and large corporations, and they are able to very willingly negotiate the terms of these contracts that otherwise look like they're boilerplate and ironclad, and that they wouldn't be adjusted for anybody. So I think that there is that misconception that you can't negotiate these contracts, that it's not worth it. And, you know, oftentimes it's not, in terms of return on investment, to borrow a financial term, I think for the looking in the long term, for the security you get of understanding what's in your contract, of really having a hand in negotiating your contract, of having an attorney at least explain the pitfalls of what you're signing, so that if it does come to the worst case scenario, that you're not all of a sudden blindsided by what the reality of what you signed is. I think that that's the return on investment is huge in that respect, of the peace of mind, if nothing else.
You know, we've been talking a little bit about you know, services and you know, purchases of real estate, rental agreements, as we mentioned earlier. You could have a contract for employment as well, and I think that is something too that people probably don't necessarily think about. You might take a position at a new firm that might have certain incentives to you, and put it in an agreement or a contract. That might be something that you know, listeners might have that could be worthwhile having an attorney review as well.
Oh, absolutely. And just recently I had an inquiry from a a physician that just graduated medical school and passed her, the boards and went through the entire process of getting her first, you know, big medical contract. And more often than not, the, you know, my father's a physician, and he always says the independent physician has gone by the wayside. And it's often because of things like medical malpractice insurance and the cost of that. So you have these big conglomerate healthcare systems, and you're presented with your first contract as a doctor out of law school, and you're just excited.
Med school.
Out of med school. And, you know, but we really needed someone out of law school to be able to look it over. And what am I signing? What am I getting myself into? If I get sued, what's going to happen? If I'm sued individually, if I'm part of a suit involving the healthcare corporation, what is my severance package? What are the requirements of just in terms of discipline and you know, what's going to happen to me if I do get terminated? What resolution, what transfer relief do I have? Things of that nature. That there's all kinds of things within those contracts that are worth having an attorney just take a look at so that you understand what you're signing. And again, it's amazing what can be negotiated when you just anticipate that something is ironclad and can't be added to.
Now, you know, I said earlier we're talking about risk and how often people insure certain risk, and we just did mention malpractice. As an attorney, your concern is, you know, typically around the legal aspect of it. How often does it come into play in your practice when you're working with someone who is perhaps a physician and has malpractice, or a business owner who wants to perhaps, you know, insure their building in case someone falls in front of it, or alcohol? Where do you come into play in that conversation with any of the risk management from an insurance standpoint, or you just refer them to their insurance agent? Yeah. I'm just curious.
Well, my experience has been typically if you have a business that you have, like, for instance, general liability insurance to cover somebody falling in the parking lot, or for instance, you know, we're getting all this snow and you're hiring a contractor to clear your parking lot. Do they have insurance? What does their insurance say? How does your insurance interact with their insurance in terms of identifying one or the other? And the same thing with the medical malpractice insurance is typically the relationship that you see is when there's an incident, the insurer becomes the person that then sort of becomes the third party in any sort of litigation, that they have a stake in the game, and they'll typically be the one to guide you towards an attorney. And for instance, we have relationships with our firm with various insurance companies that if there's an incident, they refer their client to us, and then they provide the cost of the defense or whatever it might be. And, you know, ultimately that's where it gets sort of sticky in terms of the client relationship with the attorney, because you have the third party insurance company, but you also ultimately you're working for the client, you're working for the business owner, you're working for the physician to get the most favorable outcome for them as well.
So you would suggest to them that they need to make sure that they have, you know, adequate coverage.
Oh, absolutely. I think that that's what's important, is understanding what's going to happen. They really, what your coverage is. It's like buying auto insurance and understanding what your tort coverage is and how that really impacts if there is a lawsuit against you and if you're underinsured, things of that nature. As a business owner, the same thing. If someone does fall in the parking lot, what is the process going to be? What are you going to have a say in what attorney's going to be hired? And the same thing with you know, the medical profession in terms of malpractice insurance and things of that nature.
It's funny, you know, we only have a couple minutes left, but you just mentioned, you know, auto insurance, you know, make sure you have tort coverage. I actually had a client tell me that subsequent to a car accident that her husband and she were involved in, they did not have proper tort coverage. She said for him, they had it, but not for her as a passenger. And I don't know if people even think about that type of thing.
I think oftentimes it's like so many things in life, we just think about what's the premium going to be.
Right.
And I mean, prior to coming to Gross McGinley, I'd worked for a firm that did almost entirely insurance defense in that nature. And all of a sudden, when you're on the other side of it, you realize that there are these absolute repercussions to things like, are my passengers insured? Are the people in my household that drive my car, are they insured? If my friend borrows my car, what happens then? Things like the if I get hurt, but before the claim is settled, is there going to be some sort of a fund for me to draw from to be able to pay for my medical bills, or am I going to be expected to pay that out of pocket? There's all kinds of things like that.
Yeah. So making sure you take care of yourself. So, folks, we hope you enjoyed this evening's show, talking with Nick Sandercook from Gross McGinley. And Nick, if people want to contact you, either a phone number or the website?
I think the website's the best resource. I think it allows you to certainly find us. You could call me, you can leave an inquiry, a general inquiry, and if it's not something that I could help you with, that it'll be directed to the appropriate attorney that could help you as well.
Okay, wonderful. GrossMcGinley.com. And that's McGinley. Nick, thanks so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. I'm so glad that we were able to touch on this topic.
Lori, it's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. You're wonderful. Folks, next week, we are in tax season, and the IRS is opening the floodgates on February 12th that we can file returns. So I thought, why not start our normal tax season topics? So it'll be tax filing season is open, questions to review. I want to thank Nick for being here. Lori, thanks for manning the phones. Shondi, thanks so much for being here as well. Coming up next, we have Tom Druckenmiller with In the Tradition Folk Music. Remember, pay attention, be proactive, not reactive. Make the best of your financial choices and have a great week.